Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talis, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Gualtiero Piccinini, who's professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. His new book, Physical Computation, A Mechanistic Account, is just out from Oxford University Press. A popular way of thinking about the mind and its relation to the brain, or to physical bodies generally, is in terms of the mind as a computer that processes information. But this general approach to solving the mind-body problem admits of a number of different and often incompatible elaborations. In his new book, Piccinini integrates philosophical and empirical work in mechanistic and psychological explanation and computability theory, among others, to provide a detailed mechanistic account of the sense in which some physical systems compute, many others do not, and that much of what computing systems do does not count as computing. He breaks with a number of dominant views, arguing that functional analyses of the mind are sketches of physical mechanisms, but he also says that the mind is not thereby reduced to physical mechanisms. He also holds that physical computation is not defined in semantic terms, that one can elaborate or individuate the natures of the vehicles of computation without reference to their representational properties. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Gualtiero. Are you there?
Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to be talking about your new book, Physical Computation, A Mechanistic Account, which integrates a number of different themes that you've been working on for a number of years in computability theory and mechanisms and functional analysis and the syntax-semantics distinction and its role in information processing and, of course, the notion of information and information processing itself. Before we get into the details of your account of physical computation, could you say a bit about your background as a philosopher and the genesis of this book?
Sure. I studied philosophy and cognitive science as an undergrad, and I ran into this debate on the foundations of cognitive science about whether the brain is a computer and what does that mean. And I realized that many cognitive scientists say the brain is a computer, but they don't necessarily know what that's supposed to mean. And many philosophers have all kinds of opinions about this too, but they also didn't base their arguments so much on what we know about computation from computer science and computability theory, but rather on thought experiments and intuitions that they form in some way. And so I thought, well, there's room here for somebody to look more carefully at the science of computation and see what we can learn from that about what physical computation is. And so I did that in my dissertation. And then from the dissertation, I wrote a bunch of articles. And then from those articles, you know, I kept writing more articles and more articles. And finally, I thought, oh, I should put all this material together so that it's all in one place and it's all consistent. And meanwhile, I had changed my mind about a whole bunch of things. So so that's the book. It's my more mature view about physical computation.
Okay. So yeah, it's quite a package. I mean, there's a lot that's put together here. A lot of interesting parts, some of which are very much against certain dominant views of at least the way the relation between mind and body, or in this particular case, the broadly speaking, the computer model of the brain, as you mentioned before. There are certain ways in which that has been articulated, which you think are not the right way. So there's a lot to talk about. Let me just ask you before we get into the details to just give a basic overview of your view of physical computing systems. Or paradigm, I should say, physical computing systems, because you expressly, deny that there may be a sharp line between those that are computing systems and those that aren't. But there are certainly paradigms of physical computing systems, of which, you know, human beings are certainly one of them. So could you give a broad overview of your account of what is a physical computing system?
Sure. So the basic idea is that a physical computing system is a kind of physical system with a kind of specialized mechanistic structure. And what's special about it is that it has this a kind of function, and that function is to manipulate certain entities, I call them vehicles, and these vehicles are defined in abstraction from the specific physical properties that they have in any particular implementation. So you can have multiple different kinds of implementation of the same computational system. So there's this kind of abstract physical description of some physical systems that captures their special function, and that's what a computational description is. So it's objective, it's explanatory, it's abstract, and it only applies to certain kinds of systems.
Okay, so there's a number of different concepts there that we should that we can unpack, and you do in the book. So what one of the things that you say at the very beginning is that the view that minds are computers in some sense. And your idea that that we can explain the mind in terms of physical computing systems, you've gotten very different sorts of responses.
Yeah, but can I stop you for a second and
sure.
Add a clarification? Mm-hmm. In the book, I try to stay neutral on whether the mind or the brain is a computer or is a computational system more generally.
Okay.
I do think that the view that it's a computer or a computational system captures something important about it, but I try to avoid taking this position in the book. So in the book, I'm just talking about what physical computation is, and then whether brains or minds are computational systems, I'll leave it for separate work, for the most part at least.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe we can pursue that a little bit later, why you would want to remain neutral on that perspective. Let me just ask about the contradictory responses that you that you got, as you were working on various parts of the book. Okay, so there's a very common idea of and it's vague, of information processing. The mind is in some sense or information processing, and the brain is an information processor. And that's vague, and we don't need to we can maybe go back to that issue later of what information processing is in your view, or at least how it relates to your view. Mm-hmm. But the idea, as it was articulated originally after Turing, by some early people in computers, you know, Newell and Simon, and in philosophy, Fodor, of course, the idea that thinking is symbol manipulation, right? I mean, those are the vehicles that you mentioned are manipulated according to rules. And that sort of basic functionalist picture is kind of it's certainly the dominant view that when you're explaining, introducing the picture, you say, well, mind is the manipulation of symbols according to rules, at least according to this basic account. Mm-hmm. And so one of the responses to your view was, well, there's, you're not really saying anything new. Mm-hmm. And so why bother writing the book? And then on the other side, of course, you got other pushback saying your view is just untenable, and so it's not worth writing the book for that reason. So could you say a bit about how your general view, why it generated these two opposing or incompatible sorts of responses?
I can try. So I think this kind of a extreme skeptical response comes from the notion that computation is syntactic manipulation of these symbols, but based on their syntax, their syntactic structure. And all I'm saying is just kind of relabeling this syntactic view or this formal view of computation in this mechanistic language. And there, I think that what these people are missing is that they don't usually have any naturalistic account of syntax or form, the formal properties of symbols, whereas I give a non-circular account of the kind of mechanism that constitutes computation. So I go way deeper into a non-circular naturalistic account of computation. And there's a lot more to it, too. Well, on the other hand, the people who think this is not going to work are more likely to be the people who emphasize the notion of symbol as a semantic entity. And so I reject the view that computation requires symbols in the semantic sense, a representation. And so these people would just say, well, that's just not going to work. Computation requires symbols, requires representations.
Okay, so let me then press on both of those. Can you say a bit more about your naturalistic account of syntax and of the vehicles? And then, of course, why on your view these vehicles are not essentially individuated by their semantics? Because there are a number of arguments out there saying that they do have to be individuated semantically, and you do discuss a number of them, and there's certain aspects of that you actually come to accept. But anyway, say a bit more about the vehicles and their naturalistic the naturalistic account you give of them, and also the rejection of the idea that they have to be individuated in terms of semantics.
Yes. So vehicles are what physicists call macrostates. They are defined by certain degrees of freedom. I call them medium independent because there's such abstract macrostates that they are just defined in terms of these degrees of freedom or differences between different portions of a vehicle as they vary along a certain dimension. And this dimension is just abstractly specified, so it doesn't depend on the implementation. So it's not necessarily a voltage or a speed or a mass or a charge, you know, it doesn't have to be a particular physical property.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there's a dimension of variation of any particular implementation, and then you define the vehicle as different portions or different different values of this variable. So it's medium independent in that sense. And then the reason why it's not defined semantically, or it doesn't have to be individuated semantically, is simply the main one, at least. The main one is that it's just as easy to define computations without the vehicles meaning anything as it is to define computations with symbols that mean something. It's just not part of the notion of computation that they have to be representational, that they have to represent something, that the vehicles have to be symbols in this semantic sense. And so just to give an example, you know, Turing machines are kind of the paradigmatic example of a computational system, and they're defined by their rules, and they're defined by the types of symbols on the tape, but these symbols don't have to mean anything. Okay, we usually call them ones and zeros, but we could equally call them boxes and circles, or we could call them, you know, horizontal dash and vertical dash. It doesn't matter, and they don't have to mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you can define the entire discipline of computability theory, the whole theory of mathematical theory of computation, just in terms of meaningless letters, without assigning them any meanings. So it's just more general if you have an account of computation that doesn't require the symbols to mean anything.
Okay, I guess this kind of gets us starting into your view of functions here,
mm-hmm.
Because. People, well, even going back to David Marr and his different levels, and others, Oron Shagrir, and have argued that you need a semantic interpretation in order to understand what is being computed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And although you do have a notion of function that plays an extremely important role in your account, that particular idea I wasn't sure how that particular defense of the idea that you need that semantics is kind of integral to understanding computing machines, that particular idea about function doesn't come in as part of a demand or requirement for semantics. It comes in a different sort of way. So could you explain explain why the notion of function and how and what kind of notion of function is part of your account, as opposed to the more usual one, let me put it that way, in which understanding what is being computed requires you to sort of build semantics into the account.
I'll try. There are two notions of function that come up in this conversation. One is the notion of a mathematical function, say from inputs to outputs of a computation.
Mm-hmm.
That notion definitely is part of the account. So it is an account of physical computation. It's an account of how certain physical systems can take certain kinds of inputs and return certain kinds of outputs, and those outputs are a function of the inputs in this mathematical sense. But then there's another notion of function, which is the function used in biology and engineering when we say that the heart has the function of pumping the blood. And that also is part of this account. And people have sometimes confused these two or conflated these two or seen them as in opposition. They're not in opposition. They play different roles. Okay, so one, the mathematical notion gives you the relationship between the inputs and the outputs. And the other notion, the kind of biological notion of function, gives you a resource with which you can describe what the function of this system is. So in this case, the function of a computational system is to compute a mathematical function.
Okay.
The teleological function, if you will. The teleological function of a computational system is to perform a mathematical computation, which means is to compute a mathematical function.
Okay, so the biological notion, as you just mentioned, is a teleological one. But at the same time, you argue that the relevant sort of function it doesn't depend on its history, its ideology. It's rather a matter of what it can do, like now, or maybe now in a context or something like that. So more its current causal powers rather than its evolutionary history. Could you explain that notion of function a bit more?
Sure. As soon as somebody says teleological function, they open up a huge can of worms.
That's right.
And I used to try to stay neutral on that. You know, I used to say, there are these proper functions or these teleological functions. And I would get so many people say, well, you have to tell us what you think those are. You can't just say proper function without giving an account of proper function. So eventually I did. I was not entirely satisfied either by these evolutionary or selectionist accounts of function that are so popular in philosophy of biology, or by the system-based accounts of function, you know, that go back to Robert Cummins, that are also popular. And so eventually I settled on what I would call a more an intermediate position between the two extremes, and that's in the family of goal contribution accounts. Goal contribution account is a term that I get from Christopher Bors. So my account is not quite Bors's account, but it's in the same family. Okay, so it's an account of teleological functions. So there is a teleological aspect to these functions, meaning they are directed at something in a sense. Okay, they have a purpose, or they have a normativity. And even if it's a very minimal notion of normativity, it's not ethical normativity. Mm-hmm. And so that distinguishes them from Cummins's account. But this normativity doesn't require you to look at the history. It just requires you to look at what these functions contribute to the organisms that either possess the subsystem in the case of biological traits, or that build and use the artifacts in the case of artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me just circle back to the semantic question.
Yes.
It sounds like, well, let me just sort of rephrase it now. One of the, you know, Mars top level, for example, the computational level, and I don't want to, you know, sort of pin anybody down. You know, that's just his label, right? We know that. The top level of, involves knowing, you sort of what the computation is for, and that kind of all that, as well as the algorithmic level of, you know, specifying the rules that compute whatever goal that is, and then of course the physical mechanisms. I think some people argue that is, you know, the idea that you specifying the goals are going to involve the sorts of relationships to the external world that at least some of which will count as semantic relationships.
Yes.
Right. So that's basically what I was trying to get at before. So now that we have your notion of function sort of clearly on the table, can you say something about, how you deal with those arguments that whatever computability theory says about how symbols are defined, you know, mm-hmm. without semantics, and however much it might be easier to do so, or you can give a complete account without mentioning the semantics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pushback will obviously be, you know, in order to define the goals of the system, you're going to already be invoking, in some sense, the sorts of relationships that are going to be probably part of an account of the semantics of the symbols anyway.
Yes. And when we do cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, the goals or even the functioning of the vehicles are going to be defined in terms of very, very distal properties of the environment, you know. And so semantics is going to be part of the way that we individuate the vehicles. It's going to be part of the way that we individuate the goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two things are all mixed together. And what I try to do in the book is just focus on what is the computational part of the story.
Uh-huh.
And the claim is that when we just focus on computation per se, semantics is an additional ingredient. It's not part of the computational story that it has to be semantic, or it has to have meaning or semantic properties built in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I reject semantics or semantic properties of the vehicles. It's just that they're not part of the core computational explanation. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I have nothing against individuating things broadly, widely.
Right.
Relation to the environment, even the computational description itself, the, you know, kind of the pure computational description without semantics,
mm-hmm.
Might require you to look at the relationship between the system and its environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way it's used, for example, by either by a larger system that contains it or by a user in the case of an artifact. So it's wide individuation. And actually I got this from Chagrier, because Chagrier has a very interesting work arguing that at least in some special cases, you need to look at the relation to the environment. And he takes that relation to give you a semantics, and I say, well, it doesn't have to give you a semantics,
mm-hmm.
but you might still need to look at the interaction with the environment.
Okay, good. That was helpful. So there's a number of different issues here. You mentioned the medium independence of the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's a some sort of a physical microstate, but in more abstract. That's sort of the idea of medium independence, of course, is kind of baked into the whole idea of functionalism, at least
mm-hmm.
as it's traditionally talked about,
yes.
where you have a certain amount of autonomy, right? I mean, that also comes in of the psychological level from the mere implementation level, as some people will say.
Mm-hmm.
And also the idea that, you know, if you're on the other hand, if you're giving a mechanistic explanation of the mind, you know, a la John Bickle or something, you know, where it goes all the way down,
mm-hmm.
then it's necessarily reductive. And
right.
So you provide a very interesting kind of in between an integrative view where mm-hmm. the idea where the functionalism part of the story, the you know, more specifically functional analysis, these are actually mechanism sketches, so that kind of integrates them automatically into the whole mechanistic explanatory picture.
Yes.
So there isn't. So you deny the sense of autonomy that many others have associated with functionalism, but at the same time, you seem to embrace a lot of, you know, multiple realizability and a non-reductive, you know, ultimately non-reductive account. So could you explain a bit about you know, how you kind of steer between those two with your functional analyses as mechanism sketches, how that manages to kind of steer between this, you know, it's autonomous, or, and if it's not autonomous, therefore it's reductive. You kind of go in between those.
Sure. Thanks. Here's maybe a simple way to put it. Actually, before I say that, let me just mention that medium independence, which I stress as part of this account, is an even stronger condition than multiple realizability. So it entails multiple realizability.
Uh-huh.
But multiple realizability does not necessarily entail medium independence. So medium independence is stronger, meaning, you know, somebody might be multiple realized because, let's say, it's a functional kind. For example, classical example, a mousetrap. A mousetrap, you can build a mousetrap in lots of different ways. But all mousetraps have to manage the same kind of medium, namely mice. Whereas if something's genuinely medium independent, it's not defined in terms of a particular concrete kind like mice. It's just defined in terms of differences between different portions of a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So like if the vehicle were mice, it would be, say, the number of mice involved. But you could do the same without using mice, but using little stones or using books, you know, as long as they are capable of coming in different numbers of items,
mm-hmm.
right? So so medium independence is even stronger than multiple realizability. That being said, then the question is, how come then do I deny autonomy? And I think that maybe this can be put in this way. So people used to see the relationship between these different levels, you know, the computational level and what they call the implementation level or the mechanistic level. Of course, I don't quite draw the distinction that way because to me they're all mechanistic.
Right.
But they used to see the relation between the higher level and the lower level as either they are the same and then the higher one reduces to the lower one, or they have to be distinct. They're distinct levels, and then, you know, the science at the higher level becomes autonomous, or even the level itself can be said to be autonomous. And what they didn't typically consider, in this debate at least, is that there's a third option, which is that the higher level is sort of an aspect of the lower level. It's not identical to it. It doesn't include everything that the lower level includes, the lower level description includes, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But it is one aspect of it, or one part of it, or a subset of it. And there's a whole literature in the theory of properties, you know, that defends this view that higher level properties are a subset of the lower level properties. So, and it's related to this literature, but it didn't quite make it into the debate on computation, at least physical computation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say that the computational levels, plural, because there's many of them, are neither distinct from the lower levels nor identical to them. You know, they abstract away from some aspects of the lower levels.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to understand them, you still have to understand the relationships. You know, you have to understand what you are abstracting away from. So they're not autonomous.
Okay. So let me, you know, just sort of channeling somebody who might not find that view of autonomy strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
I recognizing that there may be different degrees of autonomy, but somebody who... you know, classically like Fodor, I suppose, who says, you know, you can, you know, our explanation of the mind, and, you know, modulo your comments early on that, you know, who knows if the brain is actually a physical computing system or not on your view. Let's just, for the sake of argument, you know, include the brain.
Sure.
You know,
and I defend that elsewhere. So.
Yeah. No, so, problem. Okay. In any case, so somebody like Fodor or somebody who wants a stronger form of autonomy, if not, you know, actually a substance dualist view, would, you know, might find that thinking of the mind or the function, the processing that we call cognitive, is just sort of an abstraction, puts constraints on it that they wouldn't want to, that they don't think are needed, or that just aren't part of a proper explanation or a complete explanation of the psychological level. And in other words, you can do your complete psychological theorizing, you know, without referencing any of the physical stuff. And I take it that, I mean, that would be a very strong view. I take it that if, on your view, the idea that the, you know, functional analyses are mechanism sketches, you know, the view that you articulate with Carl Craver, I think, it seems to imply that, no, there are going to be important constraints on psychological theorizing that come from the so-called, you know, mere implementation level, which would not be mere on your view. So could you, you know, address that sort of, you know, pushback, if not, you know, objection as such? It would just be, no, we don't, we can, we should and could and can do psychological theorizing, and we really don't need to know, you know, where in the brain things are happening. I mean, that's fine for clinical neuroscience, but it's, you know, it doesn't matter for psychology what sorts of the physical constraints, whatever they are so broad that they're just not they're not necessary in terms of what we need to think about when we're thinking about psychology.
So there's at least two sides to this. One is just the computer science. If you look at computer science, there are many computational levels in a computer, and it's just simply false that they're autonomous from one another in any strong sense. If you want to design a computer, you have to understand the way each of the levels relates to the levels below and above, or it's not going to work. The system's not going to work. Even when you reach the lowest computational level, you still have to understand how it's physically implemented in the specific technology that you're using, or again, you're not going to be able to build a functioning system. And when it comes to cognitive science, the kind of Fedorian picture might have been plausible 30 or 40 years ago, before the rise of cognitive neuroscience. But now, the science itself doesn't work that way either. So if you look at serious people who try to understand and explain cognitive capacities, they don't do it in any kind of autonomous way from neuroscience. They use all the information they can from neuroscience. It might be just imaging studies, but the serious theorists look at much more than that. They look at what we know about, what we understand about neural signals, neural representations and neural computations. So the field itself, the empirical field, has shifted from the kind of cognitive science that Fodor described to cognitive neuroscience, where the study is not autonomous. The study at one level is not autonomous from any other level. They're all interconnected, and they all put constraints on one another.
Can you give... maybe give an example of a sort of constraint?
Yes. So my favorite example is the vehicles themselves. You know, Fodor talks about symbols, and his notion of symbol is inspired by logic, proof theory, and maybe classical artificial intelligence. But it turns out that in the brain, there isn't anything quite like that. What you find is spike trains. And the functional properties that seem most relevant are the firing rate and the timing of spikes. And you know, there's a lot more to say. But if you're not going to take into account these properties of the vehicles, you're just not going to build plausible explanations of how we actually perform our cognitive capacities. And so if you look at a contemporary cognitive neuroscience, especially the modeling work, computational work, it's all couched in terms of things like firing rates and spike timing. So they have to consider the specific type of vehicle that is involved in this, in our cognitive systems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Since you're just talking about vehicles, so the you summarize your account at a number of different places in which the computing involves a, as you mentioned before, a goal directed function, you know, where it's the function is in terms of a contribution towards a goal. And this involves manipulating vehicles based, as you put it, based just on differences between different portions of vehicles according to rules that are defined over the vehicles. Can you have vehicles that don't have parts?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, if the vehicles are manipulated based on differences between different portions of the vehicles, mm-hmm. that seems to imply that any vehicle, that there could not be a vehicle that does not have portions.
Right. Okay. I think I understand. Yes. So you cannot have a computation in which there's only one kind of symbol, for example. Uh-huh. So everything is just a Turing machine in which all the squares on the tape have the same symbol on it. There have to be at least two. You know, at the very least, there have to be blank squares and squares with a symbol on them.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, if there's no differentiation, there can't be any informative manipulation of the tape. So in that sense, yeah, there have to be parts, at least two different kinds of parts.
Okay. That was just a question I sort of had as I mm-hmm. Sort of thought about your sort of basic definition of a computing system.
Yeah.
Another issue that also came up was in terms of the scope. You argue on the one hand that the physical computing systems So you argue against this kind of loose pan-computationalism that some people have thrown around about that, you know, well, anything is a computing system. I mean, that's something you're very clearly, you know, arguing against, right? That's just...
It's surprising how many people accept that everything is computational, yes.
Yeah. But on the other hand, so part of the question is, you know, what are they doing? What are they not capturing that you mm-hmm. are? But on the from the other side, your view is not just restricted to biological systems,
mm-hmm.
But also to some, you know, to at least potentially some artificial systems as yeah. well. So could you say a bit about the scope of your account from both those sides?
Yes. And it has shifted over the years, but it's always been against pan-computationalism, against the view that everything's computational. So I started out, you know, more restrictive, just focusing on digital computational systems like digital computers, calculators, Turing machines are, you know, maybe you want to say physically implemented Turing machines. And then I realized that there were these other systems. I mean, I knew that about analog computers, and I thought, yeah, but analog computers are just so different than digital computers and classical computability theory doesn't quite apply to them in any direct way. So maybe it's better to just say, well, those aren't really computers. They're just sort of called computers. But then later I realized that there's something important that they have in common. And so I tried to capture that with this notion of medium independence. And actually, I got this notion of medium independence from Justin Garson. Mm-hmm. So I just want to acknowledge that. That was a very insightful paper by him that I read that I borrowed this idea from. So then I expanded the scope of the account from just digital computation to what I call computation in a generic sense, that's defined the way I defined it earlier in terms of medium independence. And that includes not only digital computers and digital computational systems, but also analog computational systems and also other so-called unconventional models of computation, like DNA computation, quantum computation. There's a whole range of these unconventional types of computation that computer scientists study these days, and they should be captured by an adequate account of computation. But that doesn't mean that everything's computational. Mm-hmm. So again, you can build a computer out of anything, but this anything has to be regimented in very complicated, specific ways such that it manipulates its degrees of freedom in accordance with certain rules. The rules have to be followed, or at least the system has to behave in accordance with certain rules. And in order to do that, it has to be organized a certain way. So not everything is computational, but you can build a computer out of almost anything.
Okay. Even Swiss cheese?
That's going to be hard, but Swiss cheese could be an ingredient, not just cheese alone, because, cheese alone is probably not going to do much. But you could build a computer that uses cheese in some form.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. So then on the other side, of course, you it's not just so you mentioned before with the biological or the idea that the functions here are our goal. It's a form of a goal contribution account of function, mm-hmm. Rather than a more traditional teleological, evolutionary,
yes,
account, or at least evolutionary history type account. Mm-hmm. And the goals here are that evolution sets, of course, are survival, fitness, things of that nature. So you also extend the view, as I mentioned before, to...
Can I say something about that?
Yeah,
about
please, because I...
Yeah.
So
in this account of functions that I defend in the book, which was articulated with Corey Maley,
mm-hmm.
So this is a collaboration with Corey Maley, and other parts of the book I collaborate with other people too. So, there's a part that I initially wrote with Carl Craver, another part that I initially wrote with Andreas Garantino. So I want to stress that this is also in part of the result of a collaborative work.
Mm-hmm.
So, but with respect to functions, we distinguish between what we call objective functions. So these are and objective goals, right? Sorry, goal. So functions defined in terms of goals, and there's at least two different, importantly different kinds of goal. The objective goal that an organism has just in virtue of being an organism. So in virtue of being alive, you have to pursue, fitness, let's call it. It boils down to survival and inclusive fitness.
Mm-hmm.
At least for some organisms, there are sterile organisms that don't reproduce, but if no organisms reproduce, they would all go extinct eventually. So organisms, by their nature, they have to pursue inclusive fitness. And so those are objective goals. But then there are also subjective goals. So some kinds of organisms, like people,
can also select their own personal goals, subjective goals, meaning, you know, we can decide that we want to build computers to help us perform certain kinds of calculations or other kinds of functions that require calculations. And that's how we build computers. And so because of that, because computers fulfill those goals, they have the function of computing. This is artifacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's where you bring in the idea of that they have a computer, a non-human computer, or non-animal computer, is still a perfectly legitimate, you know, physical computing system in exactly the same sense in which we are, or maybe. But you also say that their functions are derivative from ours. So do they have goals? I mean, in the same sense that we do.
Well, they could if they, you know, if they. Now we can introduce even a third notion of goals. So there are objective goals that organisms have, and so if we build artifacts that were organisms, you know, artificial organisms, those would have their own objective goals.
Right.
Then there are subjective goals which we choose, and so we need to have sentience and sapience to select our own goals. And if we build artifacts that have those properties, then they could have their own subjective goals. But there's a third notion of goal, which is the cybernetic notion of a goal-directed system, which is a system that sort of aims for a certain state and is able to respond to external perturbations in a way that maintains this aim. Then, you know, certainly artifacts have goals in that sense, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some artifacts, not all artifacts, you know, like guided missiles, you know, like self-guided missiles are, you know, so-called intelligent bombs. They're goal-directed in that cybernetic sense.
Yeah, that's okay. That makes sense. So let me just let's go to some of the major themes towards the end of the book. So I mentioned at the very beginning that. In a very, very general sense, your account falls into some sort of a version of the very generic, you might say, information processing view of the mind. Just looking at it from a very, very broad perspective.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of different notions of information out there, as you make clear. And you also, as we talked about before, make clear that, you know, on your view, you don't need to define what a physical computing system is in terms of semantics or of representation. Mm-hmm. So it's a more complicated question than it sounds, but could you say a bit about how your model relates to some more general view of information processing?
Sure. And so there's actually a chapter in the book on the relation between information processing and computation, in which and that's a chapter that comes from a paper that I wrote with Andreas Garantino. And the main point of that chapter is that computation and information processing are distinct notions. They're not the same, but they're related in important ways. So information processing, kind of in a strict sense, entails computation. So if you've got an information processor, you also have a computational system, but you can have a computational system that does not process any information. But, you know, we human beings, as well as the typical computational artifacts that we build, we also do process information. And so that's one reason it's easy to conflate the two, because the almost all the artifacts that we build for computation, they also process information, as well as our own brains certainly process information.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's important to have a conceptual clarity. But that being said, there are different notions of information that come into play. There is the Shannon notion, and that's certainly relevant. So there are statistical dependencies between our internal states and the environment, and so that is what characterizes the Shannon information system, you know, or communication of Shannon information. And then we can be more specific about the relation between these states and specific states of the environment. And when we do that, so when we identify what specific internal states correlate with in the environment, we can legitimately say that they carry semantic information. Now, we call it natural semantic information because it's just based on reliable correlation with something in the environment. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, my perceptual state that correlates with the presence of pens in my visual environment carries natural semantic information that there are pens in my visual environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another important notion of information, which is what Andrea and I call it non-natural semantic information. And the term non-natural comes from Grice. You know, Grice distinguished between natural and unnatural meaning. And so we distinguish between natural information, which is roughly Grice's natural meaning,
mm-hmm.
and non-natural information, which is roughly Grice's non-natural meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, it's still a unsolved problem how to give an account of non-natural meaning or non-natural information in naturalistic terms. There's a whole literature on that, and the book doesn't really get into it at all. But coincidentally, I'm right now working on that, and I'm writing some papers on this topic. So so stay tuned,
because yeah.
there's new work coming up on precisely this.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, you do talk about a little bit about a miscomputation in
uh-huh.
the book. In fact, it's one of the desiderata you thought for a adequate account of computing, that you should be able to give an account of miscomputation, which would not, of course, be misrepresentation of any sort on your view, right?
Right.
Well, let me just I want to. We haven't said anything. I haven't said anything about Turing or the Church Turing thesis about, you know, which is one of the basic sort of theses in computability theory.
Yeah.
You do go into some computability theory to some extent in sort of setting up the view and discussing it at certain points. But at the very end, you defend what you call a modest physical church Turing thesis, this modest church Turing thesis or physical church Turing thesis puts certain limits on what will count as computing in a physical system. So could you say a bit about, you know, so there's the original Church Turing thesis, then there's what you call the physical Church Turing thesis, and then there's these different versions where you think that, you know, the most defensible one is where computing is somewhere between being an effective procedure, right, in the very strict sense, and
mm-hmm.
yet is not as broad as just like any physical process.
Right. Yes. So what I would say is the Church Turing thesis is a thesis about which functions are computable,
mm-hmm.
and then you can split that into which functions are computable by a mathematical algorithm. That's the kind of the mathematical Church Turing thesis, and that's the one that Turing directly defended, and Church directly defended, and other people, and it's pretty it's relatively uncontroversial. But then there is the question of which functions can be computed by physical systems. And that's where there's been a lot of debate and, in my opinion, some lack of clarity. And I think that once we gain enough clarity, we can see that not any physical process should count as a computation. The physical processes that should count as computations are those that can be used by an observer to determine the values of a function that's specified in advance, if you will. So the observer has to be able to set up the physical system in response to specific input and then wait some time and receive an output that stands in a certain functional relation, mathematical relation to the input. And that relation has to be known. It can't just be random. So so that when those constraints are in place, then it's very plausible, given the evidence that we have right now, that for all intents and purposes, the functions that can be physically computed are at most the ones that are computable by Turing machines. So that would be a modest physical version of the Church-Turing thesis.
Okay. So I think we're close to running out of time, and I do want to get to the usual final question, which is, what's next for you? You mentioned certain work in information or representation or semantics. Could you say a bit about what's on your plate next?
Sure. It's way too much to give an exhaustive list, but currently the main project would be to write this sort of the sequel of this book, which would be a book on explaining cognition mechanistically, which includes neural computations and neural representations and, you know, explaining information processing, right, including semantics, naturalistically and scientifically. And I've, you know, published a number of papers on this, but this is such a big topic. Mm. So it would be good to have an updated account, you know, that takes in that includes, you know, multi-level mechanistic picture that incorporates neural computation, neural representation, that's consistent with contemporary cognitive neuroscience. So that's what I'd like to finish in the not too distant future. You know, there's been work by other people in this area, but I think there is a lot more to say, some of which I've said, and so I'd like to publish a book about it. That's the main thing.
Very good. Okay. So thanks again for agreeing to talk about your book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So good luck with the work you're working on right now. And I look forward to reading that.
Thanks. Good luck to you, Carrie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Gualtiero Piccinini, who is professor of philosophy at University of Missouri at St. Louis. We've been talking about his new book, Physical Computation, A Mechanistic Account, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.